Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Bankers have been hauled before Congress. Homeowners have lost the roof over their heads. But the folks who handed out bad mortgages?
Nothing. Brokers, they basically collect their fees immediately.
And apparently not much has changed. Meanwhile, it's been 1 year since the collapse of Bear Stearns. We'll hear what it was like from the front row seat.
We were just watching the ticker, watching the stock, and we were like, oh.
Yeah, you could literally watch it fall.
It was just going and going. We were like, when it gets to 10, can we go home? Like, what's going on?
And would you take investment advice from this guy?
I hope everybody won't worry and get scared and sell, because they'll lose their money that way. Let's all just do nothing together.
Okay, a second grader's portfolio beats Wall Street. That story and so much more on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Given all the lessons we should have learned from the housing fiasco, would it surprise you to learn that new home loans are defaulting at record rates? That's exactly what's happening to a slew of mortgages backed by the Federal Housing Administration. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers.
A few weeks ago, we reported that if you were looking to buy a new home and you didn't have the 20% down payment or great credit, you might try the FHA, the Federal Housing Administration. It's become the best and sometimes only way to get into the market. You pay a premium and the government insures your loan. But as reporter Amanda Aronchik found out, some of the same issues that contributed to the subprime collapse are now plaguing the FHA.
A few years ago, Amy Moore gave up her hopes of ever owning a home. It was just too expensive. But as the housing market tanked, she decided to call up a realtor friend.
And I was just shocked that for the first time since I've lived in Orange County, there was actually stuff on the market that was not only affordable, but desirable. You know, places you would actually want to live.
A few deals fell through, but then it happened.
Actually just closed last week on a condo. It was absolute hell, but I managed to finally complete one.
The condo was going for about $300,000, and Amy didn't have much saved for a down payment. She figured she could put down around $10,000, so her broker suggested she get an FHA-insured loan. These days, that's the advice of many brokers around the country.
Right now, almost anybody who has less than 20% down is automatically being looked at for an FHA loan first.
Kevin Weaver is a mortgage broker in Cincinnati. He says that as the subprime market imploded, his clients found it nearly impossible to get conventional loans. The FHA-backed mortgages were once the loan of last resort. Now they account for almost one-third of all new mortgages. And according to Guy Sakala, publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance, the FHA isn't ready for all this attention.
An agency that basically was staffed up for 2% market share, and there's been no increase in staffing or resources now that it has a 31% share of the mortgage market.
So they have way more business, but no additional staff.
You know, FHA is under a lot of pressure to do more with less, and they don't really have the capability to monitor thousands of brokers on a daily basis.
It's inevitable that people will take advantage of the situation. That's according to Kenneth Donahue. He's the inspector general who oversees the FHA.
The people in the subprime industry that have been able to elude detection, this is the business they're in.
And it was a lucrative business while it existed for a lot of people.
Fraud is a conspiracy. It involves the appraisers, the lenders, the brokers, the attorneys. So often what you'll find is that it's a natural process to go from one area to another that they feel they can focus on. The business at hand today is FHA.
As a result of this growing concern, the inspector general says that the FHA is staffing up, and they're partnering with the FBI to investigate fraud. But consumers still need to be vigilant. Go with a broker you know and trust, he says. Just seeing the FHA seal of approval is clearly not enough. In New York, I'm Amanda Aronchik for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers. And by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com.
You heard mention in that last story of the FHA's inability to monitor the thousands of lenders who are apparently still handing out mortgages to people who can't afford them. That's led to an astonishing number of defaults on new loans. The Washington Post reports that in the last 2 years, more than 9,200 FHA loans have gone into default after homeowners missed the first payment or never paid at all. Many of those lenders are mortgage brokers, and this is far from the first time they've been on the hot seat. Alyssa Katz is a journalist who's been investigating the mortgage business for Salon.com, and I asked her to remind us how mortgage brokers operated in the recent real estate boom.
During the 2000s, according to their trade group, they sold 4 out of every 5 mortgages. Most brokers have relationships with a number of different lenders, and the idea in theory is to have them work with the borrower to find the cheapest loan that's best suited to their needs. You know, some brokers specialized in subprime, others work primarily with prime lenders, but there's usually a menu, and is usually a menu of options that they can offer.
And what do mortgage brokers get out of this transaction?
Well, they get fees, and those fees can be paid a couple of ways. One way is cash that the borrower has to put up at closing. But increasingly, they can also take what's called a yield spread premium. The borrower can take their compensation by basically arranging to have the borrower pay a higher interest rate than they might otherwise pay. The broker is permitted to take an additional fee for that arrangement, which profits then the broker and the lender. And brokers, you know, and the industry more generally defends the practice as a way that a borrower who can't put cash up front for a broker's fee can essentially pay it off over time through higher interest rates.
Now, when someone's bought a house and they can't even make the first payment, or perhaps they just make one and then no more, that's usually a sign of mortgage fraud. Now, we know what happens to the family. They go into foreclosure. What, if anything, has happened to the people who wrote those loans?
I mean, nothing. Brokers have, you know, they basically collect their fees immediately, and the loan is then out of their hands. And if anything happens to the borrower down the road, that is not immediately the broker's responsibility. It's only if that borrower were to sue and make the case that they were set up with a loan that was illegally made, then the broker could be held accountable. But it's very unlikely that a borrower going into foreclosure is going to do that because they don't have the money to pay a lawyer. That's why they're going into foreclosure.
Let me ask you this. You know, as the housing market collapsed, there was a lot of talk that people who had these bad loans, you know, they were victims. At this point, if people are getting into loans that they shouldn't be getting into still, how much of that should be really buyer beware? I mean, haven't we learned our lesson at this point?
Absolutely. And I think that right now, even a borrower who wanted to take out a risky loan, let's say that somebody was intent on being reckless, would have a fairly hard time doing it through a mortgage broker. Brokers are now making just 1 in 6 loans. And I think I mentioned earlier, I think the number was something closer to 4 in 5.
Right.
I think buyers should beware with many of the FHA lenders out there. Many subprime brokers moved into either FHA or into this sort of whole other universe of lending called correspondent lending, which is something in between a broker and a bank, when the subprime industry started running into trouble.
It all just sounds like a big game of whack-a-mole. I mean, you close off one avenue to bad loans and another one just pops up somewhere.
That's absolutely right. And I think that the fundamental challenge here is that as a way of getting mortgages to borrowers, these guys just can set up storefronts. Of course, many of them just do business on the internet. They don't have a lot of overhead. They don't have to build a big bank with pillars. We've got to move back to something of a more institutional model to help make sure that there's more accountability and you don't have kind of rogue actors all over the place trying to just get their fees and outflank the competition.
Alyssa Katz teaches at NYU, and her upcoming book is Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us. Thanks so much for helping us out.
Thank you, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Time now for the audio op-ed We Call the Straight Story. And with me, as always, is our good friend and economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tess.
I believe that you, as I am, are a fan of Jon Stewart's Daily Show.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, the Daily Show has generated quite a bit of news over the last week and a half or so, from the now infamous takedown of the cable channel CNBC. This aired about a week and a half ago, and let's play a little clip from it.
If I'd only followed CNBC's advice, I'd have $1 million today, provided I'd started with $100 million.
Jon Stewart very indignant over the fact that CNBC did a lot of fawning over CEOs who then led their companies into bankruptcy. What do you think about this? I mean, generally the question is, should average investors be even paying any attention to the likes of CNBC?
No. Don't pay attention to CNBC. Look, they're infected with the virus of bullishness. It's a story about buying stocks, selling stocks, buying more stocks, selling stocks. They don't like it when people come on and they're too downbeat, they're too depressed. Now, they can come back and say, what we talk about is risk, the long term. How do you manage your money? And I'd go, you're right. We're not in the business of churning portfolios. We're not in the business of losing people money. And we're not in the business of being cheerleaders.
And really what Jon Stewart was focusing on was the individual stock recommendations that you get from this channel. And wouldn't we say on this program that you shouldn't pay any attention to any of that?
Why would you pay attention to them? I'm not going to pay attention to them. I'm not going to buy and sell a stock because someone comes on TV and says, I think this is a wonderful thing. No, I mean, this is a way you lose money. And if you want to watch it, it's entertainment. I mean, Jim Cramer's entertaining. I mean, he slams around and he yells, but would you buy and sell based on what he says? You got to be crazy.
Well, the other debate that has spawned out of this viral sensation from The Daily Show is several questions about the media's role in the current economic crisis. The allegation that we in the media did not do enough to raise the red flag, that there was a housing bubble, that the banks were in trouble. What do you think of that?
By and large, I reject it. I think the housing market bubble was the most announced bubble in history. You can go to Fortune magazine, Business Week magazine. Now, what was underestimated is that the bubble, we all thought, was largely concentrated on the two coasts, and then you throw in Las Vegas in there, you know, maybe one or two other places. The nationwide scope was underestimated, no question. So I don't want to get in a defensive posture and say, oh, we covered everything, we were right about everything. No. But when it comes to housing and bubble, I think we got a pretty good track record there. And by the way, I still circle back. Don't listen to Jim Cramer.
All right, the final word. Thanks so much, Chris, and we'll talk to you later in the show.
Thanks a lot, Des.
One year ago, a young couple sat in New York, shopping, eating, reaping rewards from high-flying financial jobs. Then, the sky fell in.
He said, yeah, I would bring a shopping bag with you tomorrow because we may be going bankrupt tonight.
Refugees from Bear Stearns, where they are now. Plus, learning to talk about finance without killing your romance. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Believe it or not, this week marks a year since one of the nation's oldest investment banks went poof. Bear Stearns was one of the first of the big banks to collapse from its investments in subprime mortgages and the like. J.P. Morgan Chase snapped it up for a few shekels, but about half of Bear's 14,000 employees lost their jobs. And not all of them made the millions that bankers did. Marketplace's Amy Scott has the story of two Bear Stearns refugees who are still reeling from the firm's demise.
Justin Brannon isn't your typical Wall Street guy. A sleeve of tattoos covers each arm. He spent years playing guitar in bands like this one. It's called Most Precious Blood.
We're just a hardcore punk band, you know, vegetarians. We were straight edge, the whole deal. We toured the world. We went everywhere, South Africa, Australia, Europe, New Zealand, blah, 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 Brazil. It was great.
But it wasn't exactly a steady gig. So a few years ago, Justin says he stepped off the tour bus and into 383 Madison Avenue, the world headquarters of Bear Stearns. He got an entry-level job in the hedge fund unit.
I figured, all right, it's time to get something stable here. I need to get off the road and stop traveling and put on a suit and tie and go back to work. And it became the least stable thing ever. I was there for about a year and a half, maybe less, and then the whole sky fell down.
Before the sky fell, Justin had a pretty good run. He met his now fiancée, Lee Holiday, at Bear. She's a bombshell with bleached blonde hair and green eyes. Lee was an artist and teacher before she landed in finance. She worked in Bear's real estate division. And Justin was making good money, less than $100,000 a year, but enough to enjoy life's finer things.
Of course. Those are all, you know, like, you know, apartment in
you
Brooklyn.
You got a tie once a week, I think.
Yeah. I used to, on my lunch breaks, I would go to, like, Saks and buy a Hermes tie. Because for me, it was like I won the lottery. You know, it was a goof. And because I'd lived so meagerly that making the salary as, like, a clerk, basically, at Bear Stearns, it was still more than I ever imagined. And I loved it.
Then summer 2007 rolled around. Two of the hedge funds in Justin's department blew up. They lost big on subprime mortgages. Within months, Bear was on the brink of insolvency.
Then I remember the day when it was a Friday in March, and we were just watching the ticker, watching the stock, and we were like, holy.
Oh, yeah, you could literally watch it fall.
It was just going and going. We were
so
like,
sad.
When it gets to 10, can we go home? Like, what's going on? You know, you didn't know what was happening. And then during the weekend, well, Lee could tell it better. I mean,
yeah, it was a Sunday. I was at the drugstore getting some things, and one of the senior directors that I worked for called me and said, you should probably bring a shopping bag with you tomorrow. And my heart just sank, and I said, what are you talking about? And he said, yeah, I would bring a shopping bag with you tomorrow because we may be going bankrupt tonight.
Bear didn't go bankrupt. J.P. Morgan swooped in to buy the bank with help from the federal government. But both Justin and Lee eventually lost their jobs. She's been looking ever since and getting by on severance. He got a job making $7 an hour as a stockbroker trainee. But that ended several weeks ago. After a taste of the good life, Justin says it's been back to eating ramen noodles.
We just go out to eat less and order pizza more. You know, walk more. You got to have a sense of humor about it. You know, like the other night we went to get like pizza and like we were like a dollar short. So I had to like find change in my Mercedes-Benz to give to, you know what I mean? It's like I've got the Gucci wallet, but I don't have anything in it.
When the couple came to our studio to be interviewed, Justin was starting to wonder if he should get the band back together. Lee had been out of work since November and was giving some thought to nursing school. But when I checked in a few days later, they said things were looking up.
Can we just get an order of onion rings?
I met them at the Lighthouse Diner in Brooklyn.
What time are you going to go to sleep tonight?
I don't know.
It's your big day tomorrow.
The next morning, Lee would start a new job as an executive assistant at a real estate developer. She found it on Craigslist.
You got your Metro card?
Yeah, but I don't think it has enough money on it. I don't know.
Justin also found a job. For now, his walk down Wall Street has come to an end. He says he'll be raising money for a nonprofit humanitarian group.
It's definitely more in alignment with like who I am, you know, like as a punk rock kid, you know, socially responsible. on meat and stuff, so I probably shouldn't be a stockbroker.
And better still, Justin says he could end up making even more in his new job than he did at Bear Stearns. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace Money.
A little more of Justin's headbanging there for all of us to enjoy. So these two had no choice but to talk about money in their relationship, at least for the last year. But survey after survey shows that money talk, or the lack of it, is one of the main causes of relationship strife. A young financial planner in Boston says she has a remedy. Lisa Peterson created a seminar called Pillow Talk: Make Talking About Money Sexy in Your Marriage. Marketplace's Sean Cole attended the most recent event, alone, and brought back this report.
You might expect the leader of a seminar like this to show up in a black strapless mini dress and stiletto heels. You'd be wrong.
I'm really happy that you've all decided to come join us tonight.
Lisa Peterson is business casual and a little bashful, standing in front of a laptop at the front of the room.
You know, we are going to talk about making money sexy in your relationship through, of course, a PowerPoint presentation, because what's more sexy than that?
She's held a few of these events. This one's in a Boston sports bar. A dozen or so attendees munch on nachos and buffalo wings, listening as Lisa tells them to think romance when talking finance.
You can light some candles, you could put on some lingerie, you could sip some wine to talk about money together.
She has 10 basic tips, a lot of them dripping with double entendre. For instance, when you don't have time for a lengthy discussion about money,
have a quickie. Try to quickly check in with each other, whether in person or by the use of little financial love notes.
Hey, baby, I put another $400 in the joint account today. Row.
Exactly.
Lisa does the presentation out of love, but there's a financial reason, too. She's hoping to convert a few of the attendees into clients.
I do financial counseling through a unique program that we started called Harmony. That's for engaged and newlywed couples.
And that's H-A-R...
M-O-N-E-Y.
She uses games and activities to help couples learn about each other's monetary habits and histories. It's all part of the same philosophy.
Taking financial matters out of the sexy part of your life and advocating it to sort of the last thing that you want to talk about, that makes it feel like a punishment. Why not sort of just incorporate it all together and make it be a fun, sexy part of your daily life?
Why not even make it the opposite of a punishment, Lisa says. One of the tips at the Pillow Talk event is rewarding each other after financial conversations.
And, you know, I'll leave the reward system up to you. Remember that the best things in life are free.
As are the prizes handed out at the end of the event. Almost everyone who turned up got a prize. One guy won a dream date for two at Fenway Park.
So the winner is Brian Dove.
Brian Dove is here with his fiancée, Melanie Pickett.
We just got engaged in December, and we've been discussing finances. I think I like to discuss it more than she does.
And he really likes to keep track of everything we spend. And I'm just like, you know, try to save money, but you don't have to keep track of it all.
They both said the tips might make these discussions less painful. And when I emailed them 2 weeks later, they still hadn't tried them. But I met with a couple who had, Matt Childers and Kayleen Conrad.
When did you get engaged?
Last March.
Yes. I should know the exact date. I know it's March. March 23rd, 22nd.
12th.
12th. There was a 2 in there.
They both work for Merck, the pharmaceutical company. Anyway, they took a few of the tips to heart, like setting a canoodly mood for their budget discussion.
So we had a glass of wine, you know, and tried to make it more casual, not stressful.
They also did a little role reversal.
Did you wear some of her clothes?
We didn't take it that far.
Usually Kayleen pays the bills, so Matt took over for a couple of months and realized how in the dark he was about their finances.
How much money was going to electricity or to gas? And, you know, what did that leave for clothes in the budget? I don't know. I just say we don't have enough for it. I realized I needed to help out more. I would act like I knew what was happening with our finances, but I don't or didn't.
Maybe in part because of his upbringing. Matt never really knew much about the family's budget growing up, whereas Kayleen always saw her dad fussing with the books. Lisa calls this their financial ancestry. We tend to think of money as a utility, but it's so intricately linked with who we are. And yet, for a lot of couples, it's the only topic they avoid.
I think people are willing to talk about things that are emotional, but money's a funny thing in that way because we're not taught that it's emotional. And so you feel the emotions inside you when you start talking about the money, but you just don't know how to be successful in that way, how to talk about it successfully.
I asked Lisa if she uses these tips in her own marriage. She does. In fact, she and her husband may have made their money conversations a little too sexy. Lisa's baby is due in May. In Boston, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers. Marketplace Money is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
It's time for Getting Personal, the part of the show where we tackle your questions. And I'm here, as always, with our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello again, Chris.
Hello, Tess.
So we've had a lot of folks write in about a particular part of the stimulus package, and that would be COBRA.
COBRA is complicated enough as it is.
Yeah, well, this is the plan that lets you continue health coverage if you lose your job. It's quite expensive. You pay the full price of the policy plus a little extra. But the government has now said that it will help cover this cost. Well, Anne in Salisbury, North Carolina, wants to know a little bit more about that. Hello, Anne.
Hi.
So what's your question about the snake bite here?
With the government stimulus package was to reimburse people 65% of your cost for COBRA. My question is where, when, and how? Both my children were laid off in the past month. My son has coverage through July. My daughter only had 3 weeks, had major surgery the week before her layoff, so she had to have COBRA. So I had to pay the premium. My concern is you only have 60 days. You know, a lot of people are not going to be able to use it if they don't start reimbursing people because they're not going to be able to make that 60-day window.
Right. So, Chris, this is really a question about logistics and how you make sure that you're taking advantage of the stimulus, COBRA portion of the stimulus package.
Right. There's a couple of points to make. Employers, insurance companies have 60 days to contact people who are under COBRA. The fact is, and it's anecdotal, but all the evidence is that companies are moving a lot faster. There are two bottom line recommendations, and this sort of starts to get to your point. The first bottom line recommendation is if you do lose your job, sign up for COBRA. You don't have to write that premium check right away. Secondly, if you're paying COBRA, pay the full bill. And there are two mechanisms for you to get that money back. One is it's either a reimbursement or it's a future credit against your future payments.
Okay. So I have made her first COBRA payment for her. I did it as second the paper came.
And when was that?
She got the paperwork within 2 weeks of her layoff.
Chris, as of what point do you get that 65% help on your COBRA payment?
It generally applies beginning March 1.
Okay, and there isn't something where you go and apply for this help. This is something where your former employer, it's really all on them to make sure that you're getting this benefit.
Right, and it's up to you to stay on top because it's a lot of money and you want to stay on top of the situation. As I say, all the evidence I have is that employers are really trying and insurance companies are really trying to make this happen. They're going to get their money back through the federal government.
So there is a mechanism to keep it going, right? That
Correct.
We are going to get it soon?
Yes.
Good. Well, that is wonderful news. I'm a teacher. I can't keep up two more households.
Well, Anne, it's a common question that we've been getting, so I'm glad you wrote in and hope that helps out.
That is. It's wonderful news.
Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
Well, Chris, we are not done with COBRA.
We're not?
No, we're not. Cindy writes in from Washington, D.C. and wants to know about recent college grads and COBRA. You know, lots of students are on their parents' health insurance during school. The job market's really tough, so they may need to stay on the family health plan for a while. But is there any help for this group? Can you get COBRA coverage from your parents' coverage?
Yes. There is always an option if they've been carried on their parents' plan. It's a group health plan. They're dependent. Now they leave. They're no longer dependent. Companies have gotten very strict about saying, you know, let's get the dependent off once they graduate. But they can go on COBRA.
Okay. So then they would also then qualify for the stimulus help, the 65% that the government will pay.
Correct. So let's just make up a number, $1,000 premium,
yep.
Which is actually not that far out of whack, right?
Right.
That means that really the premium payment will be $350 for 9 months.
Okay, so is that something that then the parent's employer would take care of?
It may be the employer may be working with the insurance company, and the insurance company is the fulcrum, but the plan administrator will be dealing with it. They will deal with the parent, not the child.
Okay. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or you can always write us an email. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org, plus Chris's blog where he's answering your questions each weekday. And we'll be back with more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We've got a Spartan introduction to this week's Day in the Work Life segment. All you need to know is the bare bones, that she makes her living in the altogether.
Hi, I'm Parker McFinney, and I'm an art model.
You know the shadows behind Parker, you know?
Somebody once said, well, what exactly do you do? And I said, I stand in front of people I don't know naked, and I don't move. How one gets into art modeling can be a vicarious thing. I actually came to it because I was a theater major and I'd quit all straight day jobs and vowed that I was only going to act. My girlfriends came to my aid and said, you know, we know you're only going to do acting jobs, but we see that you're losing weight rapidly, and hey, I've got this group of ladies that draw and paint. Would you please consider doing this? We think you'd be great. I was mortified. When I was a theater major, I remember seeing a sign pasted on a wall, art model needed, pays, I think it was like $5 an hour, and I remember thinking, oh, naked? No way. I accepted the challenge, went, and fell in love with modeling on the very first day, and realized that I was a natural. Being a natural means being comfortable in your own skin and being able to move and being able to project and also being able to sit and stand as if you were a statue.
So if you measure the width against the head, you will see that it's wide. Right now, it doesn't look as though it's balanced. So
when we're doing a long pose, 25 minutes on, 5 minutes off, they can be very exacting. Oh no, the elbow needs to move a little bit here. Her head was tilted this way. No, in my drawing, the finger was down here. It seems so easy. It is not an easy job. The first time you start modeling can be a little challenging. I remember the first time I ever posed for peers of the opposite sex, I thought I was going to faint. And then I thought, oh, no, you can't faint. You're a professional. Just focus and breathe. And I got through that moment, and I very rarely ever have that moment again. The range for art models is starting at 20 an hour, and you'll average in a year time around $18,000, $20,000. And obviously, that's what, at the poverty level? So this is not something that you do in order to buy the house. When people say to me, I'm so bored modeling, because sometimes you will hear models that try it for a little while, it's not their thing, and they're so bored. And I think, as long as you have a brain that works, how can you possibly be bored?
That was art model Parker McFinney. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Jeff Peters. Now, many of us would call ourselves novice investors at best, but we do have more than a second grade education.
I didn't even know there was a word portfolio.
How a second grader put together a portfolio that beat Wall Street. Plus, are all those tax rebates for weatherizing your house worth the trouble? The answer's up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Nothing screams green more than a home with rooftop solar panels and a Toyota Prius in the driveway. But when it comes to saving money and the planet, turns out the lowly caulk gun has these high-tech gadgets beat by a mile. Sam Eaton reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
So today is the day of my home energy audit, which means a company that specializes in fixing drafty houses is coming over to test just how drafty my 1921 bungalow is. And here they are.
Hello, Sam.
Yeah.
I'm Trey Muffet with Sustainable Spaces.
Hi, Trey. This is my wife, Meredith.
Hi.
And my seven-month-old daughter, June.
It's June.
Hi, June.
Hi.
After all the formal introductions, we sit down in the living room and get down to business.
I was last night I was going through the worksheet that you guys have as far as our year's energy, electricity and gas bill, and I noticed starting in the end of July when June was born, our energy and gas use suddenly shot through the roof, especially compared to last year before she was here, because we're just here all the time. It's all single pane windows. There's actually, you can see some gaps in the windows. You can feel the air kind of moving in and out of the house.
That's good. And so, you know, we really take a look at all of these things and how we would go about solving those problems in the least invasive way as possible, while at the same time, obviously taking into concern your budget and how far we want to go.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Okay. Let me get this ready for you. All right.
At this point, we get out of Muffet's way. He opens the front door and fits an orange tarp with a large fan in the middle of it onto the door frame. When he turns it on, all the air rushing in pressurizes the house, making leaks easy to find.
Right now, we're walking into the main living room here, and where we have a couple of can lights, and we're going to show you how the can lights tend to have leakage. And so what we have is our smoke puffer, and you can see as I blow smoke into the air, it's extinguished directly up that can light. You can see how fast it goes out.
Not good news. It means that when my house isn't pressurized, all that nasty cold air in my attic flows the other way, directly into my living room. This makes the furnace work extra hard to keep the space warm.
I think we did cover the high, medium, and low pressure.
As Muffet tests the rest of the house, I sit down with Matt Golden. He founded the San Francisco-based company Sustainable Spaces 5 years ago after he saw how much energy could be saved by simply plugging holes.
If we were to just insulate all the and weatherize the under-insulated homes in America, we'd actually offset the equivalent amount of energy as we import from Saudi Arabia every single year. And it would cost us a roughly equivalent of the Iraq War for 5 months, one time.
This helps explain why President Obama included $5 billion in the recent stimulus package to weatherize low-income homes. But Golden says even without government incentives, money spent improving a home's energy efficiency quickly pays off.
We find that most homes have 20 to 40% of the energy that's just straight up being wasted. And these projects are really small. They're almost always under $10,000 and usually closer to $5 than $10. And they have return on investment without any incentives of 5 to 7 years in most climate zones.
In other words, a lot better than just about any other investment you can make these days, especially when it comes to your home. After a few hours peeking into my attic and crawl space with a high-tech thermal imaging camera, Muffet emerges with some bad news.
Your air leakage is off the charts right now. But those things are fairly easy things to fix. And so
that's the good news here.
That's the good news. And we typically find that most of the time, houses of this nature, we can be in and out in 3 days and have all of this, everything fixed.
But fixing everything is expensive. Turns out my home has zero insulation. So besides sealing leaks, the crew would have to blow new insulation to the attic, walls, and floors. The grand total would be about $13,000. But it would also cut my hefty energy bill by nearly two-thirds. Do the math, and the project would pay for itself over a decade. It's tempting, but there's a hitch. I don't have the money to spare. And until low-interest financing is available for this kind of work, I'll have to stick with the small stuff, like wrapping my aging water heater in a blanket. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton from Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com/new offers. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
Okay, we are back with more Getting Personal, and I'm here once again with our personal finance expert, Chris Farrell. And Chris, we're going to start with a tax-related question. We are only, what, a month away from tax day? Yikes.
Yep.
Well, let's go to Christy in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And she wrote in wanting to know about spreading out her tax payments to the IRS. She recently found out she's going to owe more than she can afford to pay all at once. So what are her options for some sort of payment system? And will she have to pay interest? I believe the answer is yes, she will.
The answer is yes, but the simplest option is you go online. There's also a phone number. And basically, if it's under $25,000, it's completely automatic if it's under $10,000. But essentially, under $25,000, you can go on an automatic payment plan.
Right.
There is a charge associated with it, and then there is an interest charge. But set up the installment plan. Most of us who are facing problems like Chrissy, she doesn't say, but if it was $25,000, I have a feeling that it'd be a much more panic-stricken note here. So under $10,000, set it up, pay it off over the year, automatic, and then you're out of trouble.
And I'll tell you, a few years ago, this actually happened in my family, and we were not able to pay our tax bill. It was a lot larger than we thought it was going to be, and we did go on a payment plan. It's pretty much like taking out a loan. You know, you figure out how long it's going to take you, and you set up the monthly payments with an interest payment, and sometimes there is a penalty as well. But it's like going on any sort of loan system, only this time the loan is kind of from the IRS.
And it's not punitive. You don't have a black mark against you.
No.
You're not going into some sort of computer database where they go, okay, that's the deadbeat file. Not at all. It's really done very simple.
No, because that file would be very large because a lot of people do have to go on a payment plan.
Yes. The other option you can look at is you can pay it over with a credit card. You know, for most people, it's probably just as easy to do it with the IRS.
Yep. Okay, there you go. Thanks for the question, Christy. And now to the phones, we have Juana on the line in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hello there.
Hi.
So what's your question today?
My question is, currently I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and usually real estate is really expensive here. Prices have been dropping because of the economic climate, and I wanted to know if you all thought it was a good investment to go ahead and see if I could buy a house now, because I work for a nonprofit and we've already lost some funding because of the economy. And if it's a good idea to jump into that kind of a big 30-year commitment right now.
Right. Well, Chris, I'm guessing that you're going to say that job security is pretty much a must if you're going to buy a house, right?
Right. Job security is a must. And the second thing is it's a long-term commitment.
Right.
Rule of thumb that we've always had is you're going to stay in the place for at least 3 years. I would frankly lengthen that out to 5 years as an absolute minimum. But I think this is a great time to research that question because when the economy rebounds, you know, housing's not going to turn around right away. And the way I would research it is really almost like several categories. You know, one is the finances, you take your credit score, what you could put down, and you look at various neighborhoods and what do you really like, what could you realistically afford, and you're sort of creating that database, and then you're going to compare that to rent, and financially, which one do you come out ahead? And if you decide to buy, you're going to know exactly what you want and what you can afford.
So there's time to make the decision. I don't have to jump on anything.
You can crawl.
Okay.
You don't have to jump anywhere.
No, in fact, Chris, wouldn't you agree that jumping in is what got us into all this trouble in the first place?
I would agree. Absolutely.
Okay. No jumping.
Got it. Thank you so much.
You bet. Thanks for the call, Juana.
No problem.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we've got for Getting Personal on this week's show. But do feel free to call and leave us a message with your question anytime. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or write to us. You can find the link to send an email at marketplace.org. And Chris, thanks so much for the great advice.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. And now to some of your letters about our show. R.C. Brooks hears us in Medora, Indiana, and called to comment on our recent story about all that fine print on credit card statements. He tells us some of those card insurers, especially those that charge exorbitant interest rates, should, in his words, sleep with the fishes.
Interest rates that high used to be and should be considered criminal. You know, it used to be the domain of loan sharks and the mafia. Lending money is one thing, but gouging people is another.
Last week, we talked with Jason Zweig and Richard Peterson about how to manage our fears as the markets tank. Both warn that most of us should take a deep breath before changing long-term investment strategies and dumping out of stocks entirely. But Petria May of Great Barrington, Massachusetts, thinks drastic change might be needed.
Denial, as the adage goes, is more than a river in Egypt. Knowing where one is, good or bad, is much better than ignorance. The idea that one should stay in the market at any cost is costing a nation its wealth.
And Fritz Seegers of Kalamazoo, Michigan, thought we'd all be better off if we went back to a comfortable old savings technique.
I call for a safer investment called the mattress index fund. Just add a knife and a used mattress and hope that our weakened wealth is helped by deflation.
Speaking of investment alternatives, we recently profiled a new method of bartering called time banking. Say you spend an hour mowing someone's lawn. Instead of cash, you get an hour's worth of someone else's time for something you need done. Colin Oatley heard the story in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and warned that we may have missed a really important point that can be summed up in three letters, IRS. So we called up our good friend and tax expert, Frank Deegan.
Generally, the IRS would view bartering to generate taxable income for the participants. In the time bank, my opinion that the IRS would view most of that as gross income. So you may want to consider talking to the tax professional to make sure that you're not running afoul of any tax laws.
We're happy to get your comments. So if you have something to say, click on the contact button on our website, marketplace.org. You know that game show, Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? Naturally, we all think we are. But ask yourself this. Are Wall Street's whiz kids smarter than a second grader? The answer, in at least one case, is no. In 2005, investment advisor Alan Roth embarked on an experiment with his then 8-year-old son, Kevin. Could Alan teach Kevin about the markets and maybe even make a buck or two in the process? The result is Roth's new book, out this week, How a Second Grader Beats Wall Street. Kevin's portfolio beat the S&P 500 by 4% annually over 2 years. I asked him how Dad first approached this idea.
Actually, first, I didn't even know what he was talking about, so I just kind of took a chance.
Had you ever heard the word portfolio?
I didn't even know there was a word portfolio.
So how did you convince Kevin that this was something that you guys should do together?
Well, we just started talking about simple rules, and those were rules that he had already learned, you know, as far as not putting eggs in one basket, not playing a game he couldn't win. You know, we ate at McDonald's, we shopped at Walmart, so he knew those were companies, and I just kind of explained to him how those companies get financing, that we all own stock in them, and then explained the concept of funds that own the stocks.
Did you actually open a brokerage account?
Yes, we opened a brokerage account. Kevin got some money from his grandparents.
How much money are we talking?
I've been asked this question a lot. We're not telling how much money he got from grandma and grandpa.
Fair enough. Kevin, tell us about your portfolio.
I actually invest in 3 mutual funds. A total U.S. stock index.
Okay.
A total international stock index.
Okay.
And a total bonds index.
Kevin has a very long investment horizon. So he went 60% into the U.S., 30% international, and 10% in the bond.
So he was 90% equities.
90% equities. And again, with those simple lessons of not putting all your eggs in one basket, so he couldn't just own a couple of stocks, because I explained to him, you know, certain airline stocks that were really big, like Pan Am and Eastern Airlines, when I was a kid, aren't around anymore. So, Kevin, do you know what the next hot stock is going to be?
No.
So, rather than pick a few, Kevin wants to own the entire U.S. We spun the globe, and I asked him, what do you think the next hot country is going to be? And Kevin's answer was, I don't know. And That's the advantage that Kevin has over most in Wall Street. He knows he doesn't know.
Is it possible for us to take lessons from the second grader portfolio?
I think it is. If a second grader can do it, you can do it.
Kev, do you want to explain kind of the Macy's example of what us adults do?
Yeah. Well, let's say Macy's had a We Doubled Our Prices sale, and people line up from midnight to 6 a.m. just waiting to buy.
And if you think it's what us adults do, in October of 07, when the market's hitting all sorts of highs, we feel fearless and we get into the market. And lo and behold, the market plummets and our fear returns and overcomes our greed and we panic and sell. It's kind of like showing up at Macy's to buy at double the price and then returning it when they have a half price sale.
You know, if we're not young enough to be putting 90% of our money in stocks and 10% in bonds, how do we take a lesson from perhaps not that allocation, but the philosophy behind it, Alan?
I think some of the lessons are, you know, number one, don't bet your lunch money. You know, when the market was hitting new highs, a lot of people took risks that they didn't need to on money that they needed in the near future. Another philosophy is make sure you can understand what you're doing and understand it well enough to explain it to any second grader. Even Kevin knew not to lend money to people who couldn't pay it back.
Kevin, I wondered if you could read a little bit from your postscript to the book. You talk about how you're still going to do what you did before everything got so bad.
Go ahead, Kev.
I don't worry about what's going to happen because I think it will get better after a while, since it always does. So I hope everybody won't worry and get scared and sell, because they'll lose their money that way. Let's all just do nothing together.
Well, Alan, what do you think? Kevin's advice is let's just all do nothing together.
Yeah, I know that he's right. He's got a huge advantage being a kid. I mean, I'm looking at the stock market 10, 20 times a day and feeling a heck of a lot of pain right now. And Kevin thinks I'm just obsessing and shouldn't be doing it. He's right.
Well, it's been really fun to talk to both of you. Alan Roth, Kevin Roth, best of luck with the book, and thanks for all the advice.
Tess, thanks so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, if you get a call from someone offering to help refinance your house, probably best to hang up.
Most of the people that we've seen so far are not licensed at all doing loan modification services, so they're doing it illegally to begin with.
Marketplace Money's producers include Stephen Hoffman and Eve Tro. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something from Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com/new offers.
American Public Media.